Welcome to The Compendium, a resource designed to help you spend less time learning D&D and more time actually playing.
When I'm DMing and I'm playing this orc or this person, I'm like, I don't know what orcs act like. So we're both bards.
We're basically both bards because, again, versatility. Because bards are good at versatility.
First thing I look at when I get character sheets for my group is like, what are your flaws? What makes you, like, for lack of a better word, human?
Yeah. Know? Making a character for a lot of people is half the fun.
For the first episode of The Compendium, I thought it made a lot of sense to just talk about characters. You can't play D&D without characters.
Yes, that would be very hard.
And so they're really, I mean, you have to have a story to play, but if you don't have any people to put in that world, in that story, I mean, what is Sherlock Holmes stories without the great detective Sherlock Holmes? You need those people to inhabit that world. And so that's what I thought we could talk about today is what makes up a character, kind of on the basis level of, you know, a race, a class, a background, kind of that overarching look at what a character is, and then going forward in the next episodes, we can dive a little deeper into some of those different points of building a character and how you actually create your in-game persona.
Yeah, exactly. And making a character for a lot of people is half the fun. Mm-hmm. Like, I've made so many characters that I will never ever play. My son actually has a binder of something like 73 characters. He'll just make them and just file them away for later. Yeah, so character is so integral to the game. And so the first thing is with a character is that it is, like you said, it's your in-game persona. And people will talk about characters a couple of ways. They'll say your character or your PC, which means player character. And so there's a difference between the player and there's a difference between the character. Right. And mm-hmm. So if you're running a game and you're saying, oh, one of the players couldn't make it, that means they got stuck in traffic and they can't sit around your table. Mm-hmm. But if you say one of the characters couldn't make it, that means they're trapped in a dungeon, the dwarf they play, and they can't be part of this adventure. Right. And so you could have the player at the table, but not the character. And you could have the character at the table and not the player.
Mm-hmm. And I'll add on to that, too. We're talking kind of about acronyms. In addition to the character, the PC, playable character, there's also NPCs, which are non-playable characters.
Or non-player characters.
Non-player characters, yeah, which are primarily typically done by the DM, but are still characters as well. So if anybody you heard that term, NPC versus PC, that's kind of what the differentiation is between those two.
Right. And so every character is comprised of a couple of different big sections. And anyone's ever made a character, if you're getting ready to make a character, I mean, heck, you could pull out a character sheet right now and, you know, do this along with us. The first thing is going to be the race, right? So this is, where did this person come from? What kind of creature are they? You know,
so a human would be a race.
Yeah. All humans are the same race. That's true in real life as well as in Dungeons and Dragons. And then there's like dwarves or elves, right? So if you have a kind of a Lord of the Rings mentality, this really helps. Mm-hmm. And so that's just like, what were you born as? Were you a gnome? Were you a halfling, hobbit kind of thing? What are you? And then your class is like, what's your training? What's your job? What, as an adventurer, as a hero, what is your specialty? Are you throwing spells? Are you sneaking around, stabbing people in the back? Are you, you know, calling down fire from your god? Are you holding a shield and a sword? Those kinds of things. So it's like what you do in the party. And then also every character has a background. And so this is interesting because background is narrative, part rules. Mm-hmm. And 5th edition does it a little different than even the preceding editions, where your background is not so, is partly like, well, were you a carpenter or were you a noble or an acolyte or a outlander or a sage? You know, it kind of gives you, what were you doing before you became this hero or this wizard or whatever it was? But also in the game, it also gives you additional skills helps provide some starting money for that character and some things like that, and even give some like narrative hooks, like bonds and fears and kind of flaws that you might have. And so it pulls double duty.
I think that's good to note too, because when I kind of started playing, I grasped on pretty quick to the idea of the race in the class, but I kind of thought that the background was just like throwaway fluff. I didn't really understand why it was important. You know, what does this have to do with anything? Why do people have to pick this? Why does it matter? But it does, now that I'm learning, like, it's more of the nuance of the character. That isn't, you don't have to have it to have that physical person, but it helps build their personality and maybe some of the decisions that they have made or will make in the game.
Yeah, exactly. It'll help inform them more as a three-dimensional character, like you would in a book. And also, too, if you choose not to do it, you're actually leaving out some important data that goes on the sheet that will kind of hamstring you from a kind of game perspective. You'll miss out on some skills. You'll miss out on some money and some other things, too. And so I think, too, when I first started playing 5th edition, I was like, oh, okay, backgrounds are important. They're not just flavor text like you were talking about.
And also, if you guys are hearing us say 5th edition, Dungeons & Dragons, if you don't know, has gone through numerous updates over the years since its creation.
We should do a whole episode about that.
I know. Maybe we will. But if you hear, like, 5th edition, or if you see 5e attached to anything, basically that's just saying the most current, at this point in time, the most current set of rules and guidelines that kind of help govern the game. There are some changes and nuances to that as older editions kind of go back, but just so you have an awareness of what that terminology means.
Yeah, absolutely. And 5th edition, if you've never played or you're thinking about playing, it's one of the easiest versions of the game to play. It really is. But it still feels very D&D. It's not like D&D light or stripped down. It feels very D&D, but if it was actually designed by game designers, and it was, so, as opposed to just some guys who really loved miniatures in a basement in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, right? So 5th edition is kind of where it's at. And then you also are going to have a bunch of other things on your sheet too, but the really important ones that is going to, everything else is dictated by, are your ability scores. And there's 6 ability scores. There's 3 that are physical or material, and 3 that are like mental, emotional. They're less tangible.
Yeah. And I think our plan is to get into those next episode, because, you know, they drill down. You need to drill down into them to really understand what they do. You helped give me a great analogy for that when I started playing. And like you said, all of these different traits impact those ability scores, or these the race and the class and these different things can have an influence off of some of that.
If you have your race, class, background, and your 6 ability scores, it will basically, you can use those 4 things to fill out everything else on that sheet for the most part. And after that, it's just, you know, kind of writing that background story that really is the flavor text, where you make this person a real kind of a three-dimensional, multi-dimensional fictional character that you can actually play with and do and be really, really interesting. They're not just a collection of numbers and rules. Mm-hmm. They can be these really interesting characters like you would see on a TV show or movie or read about in a book.
Yeah. So let's actually talk a little bit about a race. It's the fundamental element to any character. And so I think it's a good place to start and just talk about what they are, some of the different races that are out there. And then I'm kind of curious, like, what you think of how people should, especially that are new to D&D, how do you parse through the list and pick? Yeah. Do you just kind of do it for a bad pun, roll the die and see what happens?
You absolutely
maybe
could.
It's a good pun, I don't know. But
it's a good pun.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about race.
Yeah, so character races. So when we say race in Dungeons & Dragons, what we mean is different kinds of humanoids. Okay, so a humanoid is going to be anything that's human-esque, human-like. So bipedal has its own personality. They're conscious, they're thinking, emotional creatures that typically have language, culture, society, but they are genetically, culturally, and physically distinct from other things. Now, in the real world, when we talk about race, we talk about where people are from, or we talk about their skin color, or their culture.
Their ethnicity,
right. And so D&D does that a little bit different, although there are elements of that in the races. So just for the sake of this conversation, race means mutually exclusive, or, you know, obviously different kinds of humanoids, bipedal, thinking, breathing, living, thinking creatures. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so we'll start kind of with the most obvious ones, human, right? Yeah. Which some people may look at that and go, why would I play a human? I play a human
every day of my life.
24/7. But it's really interesting because humans are much like in the real world, but they, in D&D, really kind of elevate this idea of the adaptiveness of humans. And something we forget a lot is that humans really do succeed in the natural world because we're so adaptable and so because we're kind of good at everything. Can we, you know, hold our breath as long as a dolphin? No. Can we run as fast as a horse? No. But guess what? We can run longer than a horse. They think that early peoples, when they captured horses, they would just chase them down until the horse got tired because they get tired faster than humans would. And then they would just grab the horse because it couldn't run anymore. Right? And humans are pretty resilient. Like if a horse breaks its leg, it's kind of done. A human breaks its leg, there's a really good shot, even without modern medicine, they're going to survive.
Yeah.
And so D&D really has grabbed a hold of this idea of humans as being adaptable. And so humans, they get a +1 to kind of all of those 6 ability scores we talked about before. And they get a couple of cool like little skills and things, but they are pretty mundane. They're pretty just basic and not a lot of flashy things about them. But if you're brand new and you're looking through the book and you're like, I don't even have a clue what's going on here, human's not a bad choice.
Yeah, that kind of brings up something else, is that being a DM, I personally am not very cultured in fantasy literature. Mm-hmm. It's not my genre of preference usually. I mean, I've seen Lord of the Rings, and I'm familiar with it, but I'm not like a lot of people that play D&D where they just absorbed it from a young age. And so when I'm DMing and I'm playing this orc or this person, I'm like, I don't know what orcs act like.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of nice, like you said, if you're just getting into this, playing a human is a good way to feel a little bit less pressure to have to act or respond or do something a certain way, because you are a human. Right. You already are going to have a really good idea of what that race would do to kind of get your feet wet in that world of D&D.
Absolutely. And there is in the book, a variant which is optional and really up to your DM if you want to use that, in the book that you'll see, called Variant Human, which lets you take less bonuses to your original 6 stats and take a few bonuses, but you also get something called a feat, which we'll talk about in a later episode, because feats are amazing, but it's a little wild. So then you have elves, right? I think all of us kind of know elves, but you're right, though. If your only reference for an elf is Keebler and cookies...
Or Santa.
Right, or Santa. Man, those guys, they're so industrious. Or if you're like thinking like Dobby from Harry Potter, or you're thinking Legolas from Lord of the Rings, those are vastly different elves, although they all make great cookies. But these are more Tolkien-esque elves, elves that you kind of would have heard from like old European mythology and other cultures as well. And so elves, they are very slight, they're very slim, they have the pointed ears, usually very, very beautiful, fair, gentle features.
Much longer lifespans.
Longer lifespans, typically about 10 times the amount of humans.
Oh, it's that long.
So if a human can live to 70, they could live to 700.
Oh, that's a good, easy way to remember it.
Yeah, it's just a decimal place move, and it makes it really, really easy. But then the question is like, how fast do they mature? If you're 45 and an elf, are you 4.5?
Yeah.
But I think it addresses it in the book. Read it for yourself. But so what they're kind of really known for is that they get a +2 to dexterity, which is kind of your ability to balance and to do, things like shoot long-range weapons, right? Mm-hmm. And if you look at someone like Legolas from the Lord of the Rings movies, he's good at both of those things. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure they could, snowboard on a shield down a staircase, but that's kind of the idea.
You can be anything you want in D&D. You can be anything you want. Don't box anyone in a corner.
Yeah, don't hate on the Legolas. Okay, I'll try. But they're really good at that. And so even if you decide that your character is just not very dexterous and they're more of like a big lunk, but they're an elf, mm-hmm. even if you make a really abysmal score in dexterity, they're going to get a bump because even the worst elf is still pretty good mm-hmm. at those things. They also have something called dark vision, which means that they can see in the dark in shades of gray, kind of predator vision from that really old and super timely movie. And so they can see in the dark. They have really keen senses, and so they get bonuses to things like perception checks, like the ability to like notice things in your environment. They have very keen eyes. They also have fey ancestry, and so what that means is that fey ancestry is indicating that they once came from this realm called the Feywild, where all of like the creatures from A Midsummer Night's Dream would have come from, right? And so it's this other dimension. They're mortal, they're physical, they're flesh and blood, but they have this connection back to this other place. And so because of that, some things don't affect them and some things do affect them, like spells and things. And then the last thing that's really notable is that they trance. And so what that means is that they don't sleep. They don't close mm-hmm. their eyes and hallucinate wildly for a few hours like humans do, which is a weird concept when you break it down. But it is that they actually will just kind of sit quietly and kind of have visions and things, but they're kind of pseudo aware of their surroundings. It's like that when you have a hard time falling asleep and you're kind of awake but kind mm-hmm. of asleep. It's kind of like that. And so if, you know, these are great characters to do like a watch. If your group party is hanging out around a campfire, sleeping out in the wild or the woods, and someone needs to kind of stay up to make sure no one sneaks up on them, elves are great at that mm-hmm. because they're kind of always awake. Mm-hmm. And also they can't be forced to go to sleep. So like a spell like sleep.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Does not affect them. They just look at this spell and go like, what is that supposed to mean? But I don't do that. Because they don't sleep. Their brains aren't built that way. They don't require that time of dormancy. Right. So here's where making that distinction before about race versus race, like mm-hmm. Ethnic groups and things. So some of these races have sub-races, which are like different ethnic groups or racial features from different other kinds of things in their race. This is mm-hmm. where the word race gets a little confusing. And so elves have wood elves and high elves. And that gives you, when you pick an elf character, you want to pick also the sub-race, which gives you additional native abilities like bonuses to their constitution or bonuses to their intelligence. And even some extra skills or other features. Like the high elf actually lets you learn a wizard cantrip. No matter what your,
makes sense.
Right, no matter what your class is, because they're yeah. just, they're those ones that are just, we live so long, we're just naturally magical, we just know stuff. And so mm-hmm. you can have a fighter who doesn't know anything about magic, but knows that one that his grandma taught him 300 years ago, right?
As a bedtime story.
Yeah, as a bedtime story. And this is how we make minor illusion. Wow. And so they do that. And there's even, like, the drow, which are in there too, mm-hmm. which are, like, the dark underground elves that get a bonus to their charisma and have yeah. some even more magical elements to them. So yeah,
it's interesting that you bring up the drow, actually, because the next question I was going to ask you is, we've talked a lot about the positives of races, mm-hmm. But there's also the other end where your race can give you some negatives. So the drow specifically, yes. when you mentioned that, I know that they have a really severe sensitivity to light because they live yes. deep underground. And so if they are subjected to being in light, they're at disadvantage for a lot of different things, or it can actually hurt them. So what are kind of the opposite side as you're picking a race? You know, what do you want to think about when it comes to the flaws that you might have inherently because of the race you choose?
Yeah, exactly. And so drow is a great example of that, because if they're going to be in sunlight, things kind of suck for them, mm-hmm. right? But also too, there is a social stigma around drow. Like in fiction, there's like one good drow, like in like the D&D novels and things, named Dritzt. Everyone else is kind of evil. In fact, they have a listing in the Monster Manual, mm-hmm. but they also have a listing in the Player's Handbook as like, you can be one, but just be careful. And so now you get some of these kind of social pariah things going on where it affects even the narrative and that, like we said, the flavor text of your character, where you might be shunned, and maybe you were even shunned by your own people, and now you're trying to make your way in the world and prove yourself and strike out in a way that's unique to you. And so it, even in choosing the disadvantages, and I have always maintained that disadvantages, the things that your character might be bad at, like a low ability score or a negative like sunlight sensitivity or other things, actually do more to form a character and what they really like and mm-hmm. making them more lived in and have breath in them. Absolutely. Than the things that they're good at.
Yeah, that's the first thing I look at when I get character sheets for my group is like, what are your flaws? What makes you, like, for lack of a better word, human? You know? And I think what actually makes characters real.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned Sherlock Holmes before, and he's a guy with tons of flaws.
Yeah.
That are just as interesting as his almost like supernatural ability to be him and to deduce and induce and mm-hmm. solve crime. And those things working together make him a character that was so loved that when Conan Doyle killed him, he had to go whoops, and say, no, he didn't really
die. Retcon.
Yeah, retcon and bring him back to life because he's like, I still need to eat, so no one else will buy my other stuff. Let's bring back Sherlock. Right. So he becomes beloved. Mm-hmm. And so you have to hold those two things in tension for sure. So next you have dwarves, bonus to their constitution. They live a lot longer, something like 5 times as long as humans. They're short, but they're not super short. But it makes them not walk as fast as everybody else.
A little bit more stout.
A little more stout, yeah. They get resistance on things like poison, where it doesn't affect them as much. They get bonus ability to use certain weapons, because mm-hmm. like as a race and as a broader culture, all of them just know how to use this, no matter if they go into the clergy or if they go into wizarding mm-hmm. or if they become a monk or something. They all just know how to use certain
dwarf
weapons.
Dwarf monk, that would be an interesting
I have a player in one of my campaigns who's a dwarf monk. Shaolin style monk, right? And they also have different sub races for mm-hmm. the dwarves. And dwarf is a great one to play. It's really awesome. I find elves, like, I know a lot of people love to like gravitate towards elves, especially when they're new, but like they do so many things inherently, like you lose track. There's so many. They're really overwhelming. So I think dwarves and humans are great places to start. Then you have halflings. Also, if you're a Lord of the Rings fan, hobbits, but mm-hmm. that's trademarked. So halflings. but just like you would see in Lord of the Rings, but they're very dexterous. They're short. They're actually a different size category than mm-hmm. some of the other ones we've talked about. They're considered small. And so as a result, they don't walk as fast. They can get in places other people can't. They have a natural lucky ability, mm-hmm. which is great. And so like if you ever roll a 1 on a D20 roll, you can just re-roll it. It's fine. You're lucky. But if you get a 1 again, you're done. Like you just do it once, for that roll. Exactly. They're brave. They have resistance to fear. They're very nimble, and they have some sub-races as well. Mm-hmm. Then you have the gnomes. Gnomes are interesting. They're almost like a cross between elves and halflings. So they're small. They're less stout than a halfling. They're more nimble and light, but they have this more bend towards mechanical and invention, like clockwork things, right? So if anyone had ever built a grandfather clock in your world, it was probably gnomish make. If someone ever made a lightning gun, you'd know for sure gnomes made that. They love doing those kinds of things.
So in that sense, I guess gnomes are a little bit more akin to like Santa's elves.
Yeah, I have always held that they are gnomes up there. But
not elves.
Yeah, get your nomenclature right, guys. But yeah, because they're making things, and that's what they love to do. And so as a result, they have a natural bonus to their intelligence because they're good at making things. They make great wizards as mm-hmm. well. They also have dark vision along with the halflings, gnomish cunning. Even one of the sub-races lets you make little odds and ends like you're going to open an Etsy store. Like that's what they do. They make little things. And again, all of this is just them as a people. It has nothing to do with their job as their class. This mm-hmm. is all just race. Then you have half-elves, which is my favorite. So they're half-human, half-elf. Like the name would suggest, they're half elves. Although I suppose they could be half something else too, but they have a lot of the same abilities of elves, but also the adaptability of humans. And okay. we really see how those two become very powerful together. They have a plus a bonus to their charisma, and then they get a +1 to 2 other ability scores, just whatever you want. And you're like, oh, wow, like that's where that human flexibility comes in.
Okay.
But then they all still have dark vision. They still have fey ancestry. They still have, they don't really sleep, I don't think. Skill versatility. They can just kind of choose extra skills at the beginning. So they're really the most like modeled or where they can, you can really kit out them to be anything you want them to be. Mm-hmm. And so that, and even physically, they're kind of somewhere between elves and humans, a little more slight than humans, a little more bulky than elves. And they, as a result, don't live quite as long as elves, but definitely longer than humans. And then you have some more exotic races. So we have a crowd favorite, Dragonborn.
Yeah.
They're a dragon man. Not like Trogdor, but like they are...
Trogdor!
A dragon man. All right, so they're just like bipedal humanoid dragons. And they tend to be a lot taller, a lot beefier. They have scales. They have that classic like dragon jawline, more like how a dog has, like a snoot, as opposed to a flat face like a human. Mm-hmm. They have pluses to strength and charisma. And we'll talk about this later, but charisma is more about the force of will. And so they're they have a presence, obviously, because mm-hmm. they're this big, scaly giant, like, you know, 6-7 feet tall walking into your crib. And you're like, wow. Yeah. And then they also have, they have different colors that match to the different colors of dragons in Dungeons & Dragons, which changes the way they look, but also gives them resistance to certain kinds of energy, like fire and lightning and acid and cold. And I know that acid and cold aren't energy, but you get what I'm saying. And they get a breath weapon. They can actually open their mouth mm-hmm. and just breathe fire or breathe ice or spit acid like their distant ancestors, the dragons. And so you get to pick that when you create it to say, oh, well, he's a red dragon, so he has resistance to fire, and he can shoot fire out of his mouth,
Something I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are is that there are a lot of races in D&D that I'm learning that harken back to animals,
mm-hmm.
but that doesn't mean that they are that animal, if you will. So example, in my current campaign, I have one of my players is a tabaxi. It's basically mm-hmm. a cat race.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that they are a cat or they're descended from cats. It's kind of like it's standalone. It's a little bit of a nuance, and it took me a while to understand, like, a dragonborn is not a dragon.
Right.
It's its own race of humanoids that right. kind of resemble, I guess. How would you?
Yeah. So, like, if you want to look at it like evolutionary biology, like this is a offshoot of that evolutionary tree, where so they're not dragons, but they're descended from dragons way, 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 way back, or okay. maybe a wizard did it. By the way, anytime you can't explain something in D&D, magic, a wizard did it, is always a really great one. Like, try explaining owlbears to your friends, and you're like, it's magic. That's how it happened. And so you can almost think of it like maybe at one point, millennia ago, they were dragons, but these ended up going more humanoid route because mm-hmm. of whatever reason. And so like the tabaxi, they're not cats, but they're related to cats. Mm-hmm. They have similar features and attributes, but they are not cats, in the same way that if you look at it from a biological evolutionary standpoint, we're related to apes, apparently. And so we don't, you know, walk around eating bananas and scratching ourselves. Most of us don't. But
I don't know what you do in your spare time.
Well, yeah, maybe not purview for the podcast. But so we're related to them, but we're not them, yeah. right? And so, you know, opposable thumbs, walking mm-hmm. upright, inventing tools, complex social structures, like simians and apes and things, right? So that's how I kind of distinguish with it. So does a tabaxi, you know, a cat person, sit down and start like grooming themselves like a cat would? It's maybe up to them. Are they, will they chase any mouse they see? Maybe, but they don't have to. So yeah. You can play with it. And so that's the Dragonborns. And then you have two other kind of like you're kind of saying half races. There's the half orc.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so half orc is half orc, half something else. Typically, they see it as human, but and they're very large, very imposing, make great fighters and barbarians, and they have a bonus to their strength, their constitution. They have dark vision. They're very menacing. They can actually save themselves from death on a limited basis. They have ability called relentless endurance. That if something's going to drop them to zero, it just drops them to one instead.
Oh, that's handy.
But they can't use it again until the next, like, game day. Like, the next time, like, the sun goes down and comes back up. So they can just, like, take it and just, like, rah, and keep going, right? And then they also, when they do extra damage on a critical hit, which we can talk about later. So that they're really, really martial characters. And then there's the tiefling, which I know we've talked about a lot too.
They're, I'm very intrigued by tieflings.
They're demon people, guys. That's what they are. They have horns. They have kind of purple reddish skin. They have prehensile tails like Nightcrawler from X-Men. And they have even have resistance to fire. You know, and so again, this is where some of the to determine in your game, are people going to be mistrusting of them? Because it's like, listen, I know that you're not a demon, but somebody in your family was, and I don't know how far from the tree you fell, you know? And so they're just a genetic offshoot of something like that, or perhaps someone way back in the day made a deal with the devil, made a Faustian bargain, and then this is just the price that their lineage has paid. And so they're related or associated with demons, but it doesn't mean they're inherently bad. And again, there might be some kind of social aspects to that. So they have a bonus to their charisma, their intelligence, they have dark vision again, they have resistance to fire, and they have something called hellish resistance, or sorry, infernal legacy. So as you go up levels as a character, some more like innate magical abilities like unlock. So they have this thing called Hellish Rebuke that if they get hit as an immediate reaction, you can just like blast them with fire, like a reflex. Like instead of like tapping your knee and your leg goes up, they shoot infernal fire and kill people. So that those are just the races in the player's handbook. There's so many more races out there. There's even some race options hidden in the monster manual too, where like this is a monster listing, but here's a variant if you wanted to play one. You're like, wait, what? Really? I can do that? Like the Eladrin has like a little like bonus thing too. But there's like Eric Croca and Genasi and Goliath and Asimar and bugbears and furbolgs and goblins and hobgoblins and kinku and kobolds, lizard folk, orcs, straight up orcs, turtles, tabaxi, tritons. turtles are the best. There's changelings. There's shifters and warforged. My son loves warforged because they're fantasy robots.
I have a warforged in my kitchen right now. Okay. A lot of fun.
My son always plays a Warforge, even when he's not playing a Warforge. You know what I mean? And like, there's the Gith, and there's Centaurs and Loxodons, which are like elephant people. And what else? Okay, there's like little fish people called like Grung and Lokathian. Like, there's just so many options out there. But if you're just getting started out, pick one of those core races.
Yeah, and you can find the core races on a website called D&D Beyond. If you don't want to invest, that's the great thing with D&D. You don't actually have to spend any money to play. There's enough resources online that you can get started just with your computer or your cell phone and the internet.
Yeah, because Wizards of the Coast actually released something called the Basic Rules, which has like 60% of everything in it, where you can just go to the website and download it and just use it.
Yeah.
And then dndbeyond.com, which we are not, that doesn't sponsor us, but we'd love for them to do that. It basically will walk you through character creation using the stuff from the Basic Rules, and it's just absolutely phenomenal. I highly recommend it for people who are just starting out. It's really great.
So I'm curious, you said a half elf is your favorite race.
Adaptability.
Is that who you would play?
Yes.
If you just had to pick? Okay.
Yeah, so I talked before that my son has like just tons and tons of characters made. I also do, but like in D&D Beyond, and like 40% of them are half elves of some kind. and I just love adaptability and play and being able to shift, to fill in different roles in the party and to always have something to do, and half elves just really fit that kind of, that niche really well.
So kind of heading on, you know, once you pick what you are, as your race, you have to then kind of go down the ladder a little bit into the class. So why don't we talk a little bit about what class is and how that builds onto your race?
Right. So class is not about your social breeding or your ability to use the right dinner fork.
How classy you are. Yes. You put your pinky out now, when you drink your tea.
Yeah, exactly. You could be... Wait, so... Let's talk about tea for a second. Do you put your pinky up when you drink tea?
I don't, but do you know why people did that?
Balance?
No. Back in the day, China was actually so fragile and so expensive and rare that you would put your pinky out to avoid putting too much pressure on the handle to possibly break it. So it was a way to span the longevity of your china, essentially, in a day and age where it was very difficult to come by.
The more you know.
Yeah.
Right on. Okay. All right, class. So
returning to our scheduled content.
So character class is basically what your training is. It's like your job, right? So, you know, we're all humans, I think, and but we have jobs, right? Like you talked about your training in film. I talked about my training in radio and other things. And so this is your job.
So we're both bards.
We're basically both bards because, again, versatility. Because bards are good at versatility. So this is how I kind of think of this is how I think of the jobs of the classes is they're broken down pretty easily as either martial or magical. So martial meaning that they are wearing armor, you have a sword or a bow, probably a shield. They're like, get up in your face and fight. And then there's the magical people, which use magic, right? And it kind of divides everything pretty evenly. And so in the martial side, which again, if you're intimidated by any of this stuff, is a great place to start because there's not so many options.
Yeah, so, I've heard a fighter is a really good option. It is. Human fighter is a really good option for new players.
They actually did a statistic a while back, and the most common class race combo is human fighter.
Oh, really?
Right. Because it's entry level, super easy, but you can make them interesting. So fighter is a great thing. Pure combat. They know how to use all the weapons. They can wear any of the armors. They can use a shield. They eventually get more attacks. Every time they say, I attack, they can attack two times, and then three times, and then four times, and five times as they go up in level and get more complicated. They can even... early on, they get a thing where they can actually take an extra turn, another action. Action surge is what it's called. And that means they can just take a single action one more time, which if it's, you know, if you can make two attacks every attack action, now you have four attacks, but that bonus, that action surge has a limited use. And then they have something like... where they can actually get some health back just by like call the second wind, where they can just kind of like hunker down and like shake it off and gain some hit points back, some health back, and keep going. And so their options don't get really crazy. They're really straightforward. There are options to do that, and I'll talk about that in a second. But it's really straightforward. It's up front, in the face, keep doing a lot of damage reliably. They don't run out of things. They can always swing their sword a bunch of times. It's really straightforward, but of course, always you can customize it up kind of crazy. And then even on the further side of pure martial prowess is the barbarian. And so the barbarian is like you'd think like the Mongol hordes or the Gauls that Julius Caesar fought, right, in the Gallic Wars. These are people who are very, very martial as well. They can kind of use all the weapons, some of the armor, but they have this kind of innate ability that's fueled by emotion where they don't have to necessarily wear armor. They can actually, there's an equation in there that says your armor is this based on, like, I think it's your dex and your constitution.
Interesting.
And that's just your AC because you're just tough. Your armor class through your ability to resist getting hit. And they have the most hit points in the whole game. Their health is based on rolling a d12, and they're the only ones who do that. Even the fighter uses a 10-sided dice. And then they have something called rage, which they can do a limited number of times per day in the game. That gives them bonus to damage. They get more resistance to being beat up. It even sometimes gives them a easier chance to attack or to do even more attacks in a round. And so it's like this fury. It's like the Tasmanian Devil. They're basically D&D's Tasmanian Devil, right? And then inside that, too, you have two kind of more like skill and finesse style of martial characters, the rogue and the monk. So the rogue, not the rouge, the rogue, they're thieves, they're assassins, those kinds of things. And they're all about dexterity and
finesse.
They're the sneaky ones. And sneaking and sleight of hand and pickpockets. And so they have a bunch of skills as well. If you like versatility, they're another great one for that because their skills, like, hey, I want to pick this guy's pocket, or hey, I want to see if I see anything in this room that determine the success and failure of those kinds of actions, can be boosted to an incredible amount, like +9, +12, and you're like level 5, and you're like, why are you so good at this? So they can really specialize in things because of their training. Mm-hmm. And so for them, it's not about emotion. It's not about strength. It's about training. And so they're the ones that they're really kind of cool feature that they're most known for is their sneak attack. Mm-hmm. And so if they have surprise on somebody or they're fighting along someone else so that the foe can't focus on just one aggressor, they can actually stab and basically turn the knife. Mm-hmm. And they'll do extra damage.
They do a lot of extra damage.
Yeah, and it doesn't run out. Like, yeah. It's not based on a spell slot or a rage twice a day. It's just you have to be working with friends or have a situation where you can sneak up on them. Mm-hmm. Good thing they're good at sneaking up on people. So if you're really careful, you could be the top damage dealer in your party just by being a rogue, which mm-hmm. is nothing really flashy.
Yeah, one of my first players was a halfling rogue. And so because of his size, he was able to hide very easily. Mm-hmm. And whenever he would hide, he would then have sneak attack. So basically every turn he would attack and then he would hide. And then the next turn he would have sneak attack again. Yes. So he was this the tiniest person in the party and he was easily doing the most damage.
Yeah, he's just using daggers, which do almost no damage at all. Yeah, exactly.
Slashing at their ankles.
Yeah, like, oh no, my Achilles tendon. And then you have the monks. And when I say monk, don't think the guys who make beer and cheese and put out a Christmas album, right, of Gregorian chants. These guys are more like Shaolin monks. These are your martial artists. Mm-hmm. And so, again, this is about their skill and their discipline. And they also have a thing where they don't need to wear armor. And you can look at a couple of stats to determine what their armor is. And they can make unarmed strikes. Mm-hmm. And so they can actually do more damage sometimes just punching you with their bare or open fist than a fighter could with a longsword. Yeah. And so they're very nimble. And they have these special things called key points or chi points, if some people call it, where they have this limited pool of points that there's a list of like, hey, you could do this kind of cool thing, this kind of cool thing, this kind of cool thing. And they're the ones who are going to get the most attacks per turn the quickest because they can like attack, and then spend a key point and attack again, mm-hmm. right? And then as it goes up, it gets even more and more. And so they have this thing, really cool thing called Flurry of Blows, where it's like you're playing Street Fighter, and it's just like boom, 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 boom. And so they're a lot of fun and all of that. Okay, so that's the martial side. There's those four over there. And then in the magic side, it splits again. And so there's the arcane and the divine.
Now, what's the difference between those two terms?
Okay, so break it down. So divine, as it would suggest, that their magical ability comes from the gods. It comes from some godly or some deity presence. Mm-hmm. And so the most obvious, and so the arcane comes from learning, book learning.
Okay.
And learning like Harry Potter, like what's the right motion and words and wand to make this thing float, mm-hmm. right? That's like a wizard. And an arcane magic. And but it also what it does, arcane magic taps into something called the weave, which is like if you like you know what like ley lines are in like some fantasy mm-hmm. stories, the natural lines of like magic across the globe, just like there's natural lines of magnetism across the globe. They tap into this and they're manipulating those elements of natural magic in the world mm-hmm. to create and craft them into a certain way, almost like they're playing with the source code of reality to create and craft their spells.
Right? Yeah, I think my favorite lore that I've heard on that is bards, where they're basically tapping into the echo of the voice that spoke everything into existence.
Right.
Which
the
I'm
song
like, just,
of creation.
Just the idea of that is so cool.
Yeah, exactly. Like they found the secret chord that pleased the Lord, right? Like, mm-hmm. so like that's what they're doing and it's super awesome. Like I said before, we grew up in church. And so for us, we're like, that resonates with us in a very special way. And so we're like, yeah, that's super cool. So don't let me talk too much about bards. I'll get them in a second. Okay. So on the divine side, you have the cleric. Okay. They're not filing paperwork. These are priests. Okay. And so they are somewhat martial. They can wear some armor and they have some restrictions and they can have pretty good weapons, but really their go-to is every day they pray and they get new spells. And they can choose brand new spells from a list every single day. So they can kit themselves out into different spells every single day. So they can be like their sneak complement or their damage dealing complement or healing and disease prevention complement. And so it's really cool. Yeah. And they pick a deity or a pantheon and that also has elements of what do they specialize in. Mm-hmm. And so they're very magically based, but they also can do a lot of things up with the frontline fighters and barbarians and stuff, which is kind of neat. They're actually one of the more versatile characters, too, that have magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A couple things that I think are interesting that I learned about clerics, you know, as I was running a game that had one, was I didn't necessarily understand well at first that their powers come from their deity. So they're not just imbued. They can't just always cast this thing. If they're making their deity angry, mm-hmm. they might go to cast a spell and it might not work because their deity is like, no, I'm not going to give you the power to do that. So that was something interesting because it nuances the character and or the player in their gameplay. Like if they're doing things that if you worship the god of life and mm-hmm. you're going around killing a bunch of people, well, that's not going to be something that makes your god very happy. So they might cut you off. They might not let you cast anymore.
Right, and make you go on a quest to fix that. Now you have those really cool side quests. And so as a DM, this narrative element, because it's not like a game mechanic. It's not a table you roll on to see if you made god angry.
Yeah.
Although I shouldn't write one. But it's more of a narrative thing and where you get a chance to play your character. And so if, you know, you are a cleric of the god of life or the god of knowledge, does that mean keeping and protecting knowledge, or does that mean distributing knowledge, mm-hmm. or does that mean destroying forbidden knowledge or discovering forbidden knowledge? Like what relationship do you have with that aspect or concept that that deity Absolutely. Personifies? So they're very interesting. You got a lot of layers in there. So, and then there is this is really interesting, there's a more martial version of the cleric called a paladin that are like basically like fighters that can cast some spells. And they have a really cool thing where they have something called smites, right? So these are paladins smiting the wicked, where they can channel magical energy into their blade to do extra damage and sometimes extra effects. Okay. And so that's why we said the rogue was so powerful, because you've got this extra damage that can come from the paladin, but he's using spell slots, this kind of limited resource mm-hmm. every day to do this, and he runs out, but all the rogue has to do is sneak around behind his friend and stab, 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 stab. Mm-hmm. So they're really cool, and they have some really cool like divine powers at certain levels. They just can't get sick anymore.
Well, that's handy.
It is, isn't it? Or they can lay on hands and just give hit points or cure people of disease. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very like kind of
it's
like
very biblical in that
sense.
Yeah,
it really is. Like I think of like was Mother Teresa a paladin? Like, you know, you think of this kind of stuff and you're like, that's actually kind of cool. Like they're these bastions of good and bravery and hope, and they're very sometimes very rigid in what they believe because they hold this very specific line thematically, but at the same time they have this element to them where you could see them crouching over the bed of a sick child and laying hands on them and he's well, and like makes this like kind of touching moment and you're like, wow, there's a lot you can do with these characters. Mm-hmm. And then you jump over also in the divine side and you have druids. So druids, mm-hmm. they will probably worship a deity, but they're more like worshiping creation itself, whether that's plants or animals and those kinds of things. And they're very, very magical as well. They pray to get their spells and their spell slots, but they have a really cool ability where they have something called wild shape. Where a couple of times a day, depending on their level, they can just turn into an animal with some restrictions, like they had to have seen it before, or it can't be over a certain like hit point level. They call it a challenge rating, but we'll talk about that later. So like they can turn to a bear or a wolf or an eagle or an elk or a squirrel or a mouse. Like they can be this hulking like a dragonborn and then just turn into a mouse that's real size and sneak into a castle mm-hmm. and then just change back and sneak it behind the guard, which is a beautiful image. So they're really cool like that because they have this kind of like affinity and resonance with the natural world that shows up in their magics as well as in their ability to just change into the natural world, which is kind of neat. And there's a slightly martial, more martial version of them called the Ranger, which has some kind of natural, plant, animal-based magics but they're also typically really good at like bow and arrows, mm-hmm. or wielding two weapons at once and hack. They can get like, and they have like favored terrain, like they're mm-hmm. really good in forests but not deserts, and they can be good at killing certain kinds of bad guys, like bad guys that are bigger than them, or when they have to fight a horde of things, they're good at fighting those kinds of things. And so it's interesting that there's like these kind of purely magical versions, and there's a slightly martial version that's adjacent to them in the divine kind of category. And then lastly, you have the arcane. These are the guys who are using kind of the weave of magic to create magical effects. So the top of that list most obviously is wizards. Mm-hmm. This is Merlin, this is Gandalf, Harry Potter, although he might be more of a sorcerer, where they get their magical ability from book learning. Simple mm-hmm. as that. They have to carry around a spell book. They study it each day to rememorize those spells, because once they cast the spell, it like leaves their mind. In a way, so that they can't use it again with spell slots and all this kinds of stuff. And so they're actually some of the most frail characters. Like, their mm-hmm. hit points are based on a 6-sided die as opposed to the barbarian's 12-sided die. And they typically need to keep their best score be intelligence, which isn't going to help them. And they can't wear armor mm-hmm. unless they have an ability like being a dwarf, where they just know how to wear armor because that's cultural. Mm-hmm. They just can't wear armor, and so they're wearing, like, you know, robes, and arrows go really great through robes. Like, there's no protection at all. And they don't know how to use very many weapons. But their magics, like a lot of the magic users, even in the divine category, they have these things called cantrips, which are simple spells that they can cast all day long. They never run out. They don't forget how they're just very fundamental, basic, beginner-level mm-hmm. spells, where they can shoot a bolt of fire, or they can create a spectral hand that grabs onto the opponent and drains them of health and keeps them from being able to regenerate. Those kinds of things, or like creating illusions or cleaning their clothes. There's a great spell that's a cantrip called Prestidigitation, and one of its many, many abilities is you can soil or clean a single garment. And I'm like, where is that in my life? That's what I want. And then they have a counterpart called a sorcerer that has a lot of spells too, a lot of the same restrictions, but their magical ability doesn't come from learning. Their magical ability comes from genetics. They are related to something.
So that's
something.
Why you were saying Harry right, Potter is because, more of a sorcerer, because it's in his blood.
Exactly. Okay. So they're sorcerer wizards.
Gotcha.
Whereas the Sorcerer Supreme, Doctor Strange, isn't a sorcerer. He's definitely a wizard because uh-huh. he had to train and learn and read and all that stuff. So sorcerers, like, the two most common options are they have some kind of connection to the Feywild. We talked about that with the elves mm-hmm. before, where there's this wild magic in this other dimension that they're infused with somehow that just gives them magical power. Or the other common option is that there is a draconic bloodline in their bloodline. That way back when somewhere, Grandpappy, he's actually a dragon. Right? And you don't have to be a dragonborn to do that. You could be a human and just one day, like you're one of Xavier's students for X-Men, you just burst out with magic powers. So that's kind of the vibe there. And they have these cool things called sorcery points that's like the monk's key points. That's a small pool of expendable resource along with their spell slots, like always, that they can spend to do cool little extra tricks as they're learning to kind of craft their magic in very unique ways. And then you have the last two arcane classes, which are Bard and Warlock. And they get their magical powers the most kind of fun ways. We talked a little bit about the Bards already. They are in tune with the echo of the song of creation, where they have figured out rhythms and chords and music and even oration that allows them to kind of hijack that source code of reality a little bit, because reality remembers being formed, and they tap into it a bit to create these spell effects. The Bard is also really cool because it's a bit more of a martial version of the wizard.
Mm-hmm.
So they can use more weapons. They can wear some armor. They have some better abilities. Their hit points are a little bit better. And so just like how the cleric has the more martial companion of the paladin, the wizard has a bit more of a martial companion of the bard, which is a weird way to think it, because in previous editions, mm-hmm. the bard was kind of a joke. Like, mm-hmm. it's like Tom Bombadil from Lord of the Rings. Like, you're like, you play a lute and walk around with us. Like, yeah, maybe you can get us free drinks at the tavern, But what do you do exactly for the party? They were a joke. And in fifth edition, they're so much better. Like, almost like you can tell they were overcompensating for something, where some people think that they might be overpowered. But I love playing them, not because they're overpowered, because they are so diverse, because they can cast some spells. And because some, they can even cast some spells that are traditionally seen as divine spells, as well as arcane spells. And they can wear some armor, and they have some discipline and training like a rogue does, and they can fight like a fighter a little bit. So they're a mixed bag. So I really love them for versatility. And then you have the warlock, which is a bit more an offshoot almost of like the sorcerer, if you want to think about it in these kind of like, think of them like these hierarchies, of breaking them down, where they basically made a deal with a much, much more powerful entity, and now they have borrowed some of their power and they can use it. The way I described it to you was they are the magical sugar daddies, right? So they are basically saying, listen, if you give me some of your power, I will do things for you. And that's represented by something called a pact. They've signed a document, or they have made a deal, and there's a representation of what that pact is, whether it's a book or an animal that stays with them called a familiar. Right. Mm-hmm. It could be a snake, or it could be a bird, or a crow, or an imp, a little demon, you know, or it can be a blade, like it's a magic weapon that kind of has ties back to this other creature. And that other creature, the patron, could be a fey creature. We talked about them a bunch. They highly magical, very wild. It could be a celestial, like an angel that's like, take this sword and smite thine enemies, you know. It could be a demon. It could be a fiend, where very Faustian, which is where this idea comes from. Or it could be, even in the book it has this, in the Player's Handbook, the unknown, the forgotten, which it's just Cthulhu.
Okay.
It's Cthulhu. Like, let's not mince words, it's Cthulhu. And those have some really interesting abilities, and they have less magic, but the magic they do have is very powerful, and they have some really cool always-on powers, basically, called invocations, that can let them just detect magic whenever they want, or they always do more damage with their sword, that kind of thing. And so they weren't born with it, but they have found a way to conscript natural magical ability from somebody else. They're like adopted into natural magic by their magical sugar daddy.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of, I'm not sure if you're as big of a Disney person as I am, but Princess and the Frog. Shadow Man is by far one of my favorite villains of all time, and he's a sorcerer, essentially.
He's a warlock.
A warlock, yeah.
Yeah, he's absolutely a warlock.
Borrowing this power from the other side, and when he can't repay his debts, he is the payment. So it's kind of that idea of, you know, you can do this, but you have to answer for it.
Yes.
To somebody or something.
Yeah, there always will be a cost of some kind, which is a great, again, narrative hook for a dungeon master to use, that, well, what is your patron's real motivation here? Did this angel really want you just to kill the wicked? If that's the case, why didn't he do it? What's really going on here? Was he even an angel in the first place?
Yeah.
Is a fallen angel? You know, who knows? And so it's very, very interesting. And you're right. I'm not as big of a Disney fan as you are. No one is. You're a huge Disney fan. Like, there's like a million pieces of Disney artwork in your house. And Princess and the Frog is the one I haven't seen all the way, because I find it too scary. Because he's a warlock and it's weird. And it's kind of creepy. That one always creeps me out. But yes, he would be a warlock for sure.
You did touch on something too that I think you and I talked about a lot when I was starting to DM, which I think is important to make a note of real quick, is that deities aren't always holy or good.
Correct.
And that was a really hard concept for me to wrap my brain around at first, because I was thinking God, good. Not necessarily. It's not even necessarily God. It's just a magical entity. And that could be, you know, with the cleric, it's not always a good God that you're serving. It could be the God of death, or it could be, you know, the God of fighting or war. And so your job as a cleric might be to spread destruction. And so for me, like, I had to kind of get my mindset out of that idea of good versus evil.
Right.
It's a lot more gray in D&D as to kind of how you can shape it, or what it actually might look like, or how it might play.
Yeah, exactly. And part of that is because the three largest religions in our real world are all monotheistic. And so many people in the United States where we live are monotheistic. We kind of forget about that. There are a lot of cultures even today that are have a pantheon.
Absolutely.
India being a prime example of this. So the way you think about it is go back to the Greek and Roman gods. That's the easiest way to get yourself right in the right frame of reference for that, because, yeah, Zeus is in charge, but go read some of those stories. He is not good. Mm-hmm. He's not even faithful to his wife by a long shot. And maybe don't read Greek stories to your kids, but... but
PSA there, guys.
Yeah, like, they are basically just super-powered humans. Like, they're very petty and small in some ways, even though they're incredibly powerful and have whole dominion over certain aspects or elements of society or creation. So, mm-hmm. like, Poseidon's this god of the sea and earthquakes for some reason. and, like, tsunamis, I get it. And, like, and the sky in clouds and thunder and lightning is Zeus. And then their other brother, Hades, is in charge of the ground and the underworld. Whereas others are in charge of wisdom and learning, and others are in charge of parties and drinking, mm-hmm. or creating, crafting, and metalworking, like Hephaestus, right? So the gods of D&D are very much like that, where you pick one and they typically have what is called a domain, where they are going to be in charge of a certain aspect. Now, if you have like a war domain, and that is one of them, like Ares or something, it doesn't mean you can't cast healing spells. It just means you're really good at casting those damage spells or those warlike spells. So you have to kind of open up maybe what you're used to a little bit in that realm of things.
Yeah. The last part of making a character is the background. And I think it kind of a good segue is from what we were just talking about, how you were talking like the god of drinking. There might be certain backgrounds that lend themselves to you having good, really good knowledge of how to brew beer.
Yes.
Things. And that's kind of where the backgrounds come in. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's where
yeah.
you can kind of influence and nuance your character a little bit with your
yes.
past. And so let's use your favorite... class and race as an example. Let's say we have a half-elf bard.
Right.
That's going to be a much different character if it's an acolyte versus maybe a hermit.
Right. So I actually made a half-elf bard with an acolyte background that it, because the bards could cast some kind of, traditionally speaking, divine spells, I had that character growing up in the church on the path to be a cleric, but who has a crisis of faith and leaves because he's like, look, other people can do what we do and they don't believe in God at all. What's the point of all this?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And others where I made a cleric, a human cleric, but I gave him an urchin, an Oliver Twist kind of background, which gives them some skills and abilities, kind of like being a rogue. And that cleric's domain was trickery.
Mm.
Which gives you good things like stealing mm-hmm. and doing illusions and lying to people. And he was a thief as a child. So he's a cleric, but he's also kind of a rogue, a thief.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could, that's where you really can put in that, like, that put the English on the ball, where you can really
yeah.
just change something so completely
mm-hmm.
And make them just really interesting and different and whole cloth. And there's a character that is on a stream that I watch where he's a warlock, but he has a scholar's background, which means that he studied a long time in libraries and knows secret knowledge and things. And he's like in his pursuit of unknown knowledge and lost information, he discovered this great old one. This is Cthulhu-esque, who ends up becoming his patron, which is why he's a warlock, even though his background would suggest, well, why not a wizard,
mm-hmm.
right, or something else. And so it really gives you an ability to kind of figure out where they've been and maybe even where they're going and what they want to accomplish as a character. And so you've got stuff like acolyte, like growing up in the church. You've got stuff like a charlatan, where you suddenly are good at deceiving people and doing sleight of hand things, and you even have a disguise kit now. You could be a criminal or a spy, an entertainer, which is fun because it's like, oh, well, a bard, obviously, but what if you're an entertainer as a fighter?
Mm-hmm,
what if
like you used a gladiator.
To, yeah, exactly. Or you were a strong man in the circus.
Oh, yeah.
Right? You know? and you could be a different, like, folk hero, like you saved your village once.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Wizard of Earthsea, the main character in that, Ged, he's a folk hero. He saved his village once before he understood how his magic really worked. So he's a wizard, but he's a folk hero too. And there's the gladiators in Heroes 2 is one of the expansions, a hermit. Aragorn in Lord of the Rings, he would be considered a hermit. There's a noble, you're from a noble family, but you leave it all to go do something else. Like Prince Caspian from mm-hmm. the Chronicles of Narnia would be a noble, but now he's a fighter. There's sage, sailor, urchin, a bunch of different kinds of things. And so those things will give you extra skills. They'll give you some new tools, equipment, and even let you know some things like, hey, here's some suggested character traits that you can do for that flavor, and some yeah. ideals that you hold to be true, and bonds that you have with other people for good or bad, and even flaws that you have as a character, and even your starting gold beyond the equipment you get just for being that class mm-hmm. all come from your background. Don't skip the background. It's important.
Yeah. And I mean, what's interesting is like I said, when we started talking, I didn't really see what's the point of the background. I don't understand why this is here. I don't understand why it matters. But as a DM, essentially the background information is what I go to first on my player's character sheets.
Oh, really?
Is I want to see what are your weaknesses? Where did you come from that kind of led you onto this path to be whatever, career that you ended up choosing. For example, if there is an urchin, it might give me inspiration as a DM to put you in a busy city where you see hungry children that are kind of trying yes. to sneak around or something. And maybe that's meant to distract you from what you're supposed to be doing, but I'm giving your character a chance to really kind of bloom and mm-hmm. explore this past that might be haunting you or might have given you this thought of, I have to help others that are in the predicament that I used to be in, and I can kind of mold so many more interesting story hooks around backgrounds than I can a race or a class.
Yeah, absolutely. And gives you those narrative hooks to really bring people into the story in an emotional way. My friend Tristan, her character is not very socially adept, has almost like social anxiety. And her background is Outlander because she grew up just with her mom. Her mom dies and she's just by herself in the woods as a ranger. And just, or a druid or whatever she is, and just isn't used to being around people or mm-hmm. in cities. And so a lot of the personality of that character is doesn't like physical contact, doesn't like talking to people, loud places, an introvert. And she did that through choosing her background as Outlander.
Yeah. And I think too, bringing all of this together a little bit as we wrap up kind of some of this overview of building a character, something that I find really interesting about as a player, the person playing the game, creating a character, that person that lives in the game, you can decide whether you want to build a character that aligns kind of parallel with your personality or give you an opportunity to explore maybe this other part of yourself that you're not very strong in. For me, I am an introvert, so it'd be really interesting for me to create a character that's maybe like a highly charismatic bard.
Right, where, or something braggadocious, yeah.
Yeah, or, something like that. So it's an interesting way to be able to decide, do you want to be in your safe zone and play in the area that you just know so innately from your own personal experiences, or do you want to explore something new and try to, understand what it would be like if you had been raised under these circumstances, or, if you were put in a position where, instead of playing it safe, like you might in everyday life, you're the first one that's charging in at the sign of danger.
Yeah.
And just challenging some of those perceptions and thoughts and giving you a way to do that, depending on how you orchestrate race, class, and background all together.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the magic of Dungeons & Dragons, is that you can be somebody else and you can even try on things of your personality that you're not comfortable with to say, well, what would it be like if I was more assertive? Or what would it be like if I wasn't always the first person to talk? I actually struggle with, as a real person, and explore those things and say, oh, this isn't as bad as I thought it was, or this is harder than I thought it would be, but I'm glad I did it. And you can challenge and push yourself as a real human being. And again, in a place that is safe with people who care about you, and really work out things around the table. Just don't make the table about your own personal therapy unless the table's all cool with that. So that's everything for character, class, and background.
Yeah. Something for everybody that's listening that might be fun if you're still trying to understand how these things would come together would be, you know, we gave a couple examples in this episode of how you can illustrate these examples with existing fictional characters. So if you're still struggling to understand how to build these things, you might just take, okay, how would I make Harry Potter? Mm-hmm. Well, he's a human, he's a sorcerer, and then his background might lend itself to maybe hermit or something because he was reliquated away under the stairs. And so it's a way that it might help kind of cement some of these concepts. Yeah. If you just take some of your favorite characters and try to apply these attributes to them.
Reverse engineer that, yeah.
Yeah, just to understand how they work a little bit better, how you can pull them out of your stereotypes of what that person looks like. You know, the wizard is Merlin. Well, not necessarily.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a fun exercise you can try at home as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you guys for tuning in to the compendium this week. We hope this was helpful information for you. Next week, we're going to dive even further into building a character as we start looking into the ability scores, what those mean, how to understand them, how they come into play in the game, and a few other things. So make sure that you subscribe to the compendium on iTunes and follow us online on Instagram at the compendium. We're also on Facebook, and we hope to see you guys here next time.
Thanks for tuning in.